The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher and other podcast platforms. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking during these unprecedented days. One of the great things about having guests return to the show these days is getting the chance to do sort of a then and now comparison about how they were working and thinking 4 years ago versus today. And today is such a day. I'm welcoming back Margot Lipsey for the full hour with her latest novel, The Boy in the Field. Margot Lipsey is the New York Times bestselling author of 8 previous novels, including Mercury, The Flight of Gemma Hardy, The House on Fortune Street, Banishing Verona, Eva Moves the Furniture, The Missing World, Criminals, and Homework. As mentioned, she was on the show with me in 2016 when Mercury came out. You can find a podcast of that on our website. She also published The Hidden Machinery, Essays on Writing. Margot was born in Scotland. She now lives in the Boston area and is a professor of fiction at the Iowa Writers Workshop. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Vogue, and The Atlantic, and she is the recipient of grants from both the National Endowment of the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. Margot's 9th novel, The Boy in the Field, is published by Harper's, and it will drive much of our discussion this morning. Margot, welcome back.
Thank you, Mary. It's such a pleasure to be here again.
Oh, I love, like I said, this opportunity to, you know, to chat again, to meet again. You know, so many authors I just get to talk to once. And it's fun to sort of, you know, start tracking writers' work and how it's changing and how, you know, new things they're thinking about. So this is really a treat. We have more time today than we had last time, and we didn't get to talk last time about your initial path into writing. I know you grew up at this private boys' school in Scotland, and that alone is fascinating. But I'd love just for you to talk about, you know, if writing was just kind of always the plan, how you approached it, how you got into it, and kind of that you know, story into your career.
Writing was not always the plan, although I was always writing stories. It was my father, my elderly father and stepmother, one of the few times they praised me was when I was sitting writing. So I got a lot of positive reinforcement in a certain sense. But I had always pictured doing something much more exciting than writing. I wanted to be a veterinarian. Growing up in the countryside, there were lots of animals around, and I thought how nice to be able to help them. Mm. And I read a wonderful book called The Nun's Story. The nun of the title goes to Africa and helps people. And again, I thought, I wasn't Catholic, but I thought, oh, that sounds cool. Nice uniform, I'll go to Africa. I read a book that I think many people probably read about Marie Curie and decided I'd find a new element. I had quite a number of plans. And when I went to university, it was to study literature and philosophy. But even if I'd wanted to study it, creative writing wasn't taught at that time. So it wasn't until after university when I went traveling with my boyfriend of the time. We were spending a year going around Europe and North Africa. And he did something very annoying after we'd been traveling for about 3 weeks. He started to write a book. And it was extremely boring to watch him write his book. And after about another 3 weeks, I thought, oh, I'll write a book. And of course, I didn't have a library. We were moving every few days, and I didn't really know anything. I wasn't going to, I don't know, write a history of the Crusades, for instance. So I decided to write a kind of book that I felt amply qualified to write by many years of reading and writing, namely a novel. And I did, in the year we spent traveling, write a novel insofar as I wrote a pile of pages about made up people doing made up things.
And so I love that in the nonfiction book that you wrote, the Machinery, The Hidden Machinery, you kind of, it's this really wonderful, I highly recommend it, sort of autobiographical account of how this all came to be, how you had kind of this stack of pages that amounted maybe to, you know, not Pride and Prejudice, as you said, and, you know, how you could shape and work with that over time. And I'd really just love to give a shout out to that book of essays for writers, because it's, first of all, it's wonderful comfort. And second of all, it's really a really great roadmap for people who maybe aren't pursuing the MFA route of how you sort of go about this self-taught education of becoming a novelist.
Thank you for that, Murray. The essays were written over maybe 20 years. Most of them began as talks at writers' conferences or at the Warren Wilson College Low Residency MFA program where I teach. And I eventually began to realize that they had a sort of common connection, a common thread, if you will, namely thinking about how the novels and stories we love, how they work, and how the writers conceal the machinery that makes them work. And once I realized that, I very much wanted to put them together into a book, and I was lucky enough that Tin House agreed to publish it.
Yeah, they're a great publisher. They're a great publisher. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that. I love hearing your sort of these little seeds, because you mentioned philosophy. There's a philosopher in the book we're going to talk about today. And it's just really fun, I think, to talk to writers about sort of their nest, you know, all the twigs and leaves that they bring back to their nest over their years of their life, and then how it sort of morphs and comes out in their fiction. And, you know, philosophy is just one example of that, certainly. You know, where you grew up and how you grew up has appeared in a lot of novels. The veterinary connection, I think, played probably a role in Mercury with the horses. So it's just fun to see sort of what writers pull in, how they transmute it, and how it comes out in their creative work.
No, I find that fascinating too. And I've recently been on a Willa Cather binge. I've just read, I think, 5 of her novels now. And it's so interesting to see the landscapes and the psychological tropes, if you will, that she returns to. And also her wonderful, wonderful gift for getting characters on the page.
We had talked about this last time, and you know, we were kind of looking across all of your novels. Then there were 8, and now there are 9, about the things that had interested you from the very beginning. It's kind of fun to think that this year marks the 30th year since your first novel came out. So you have these 9 novels across 30 years. And we'd been talking about, you know, sort of the things that have always interested you, this notion of betrayal and you know, failing people, not even intentionally failing other people, but, you know, betrayal through failure of not paying attention and ethical questions. And so that conversation was so interesting in light of the book you wrote now. It seems like that it's still been on your mind. So many of those themes played a role in this novel as well. Was that kind of always there, you know, kind of, can you tell where the seeds of your interest were born, you know, back in the day, or are these themes just kind of mysterious to you?
Some things I absolutely know the origins of, and some remain hidden, and I don't probe too deeply. In a way, I think it's better if I don't exactly know what spurs my interest. I think one of the big things that happened for me between writing and publishing Mercury and embarking on The Boy in the Field was discovering that after 40 years of believing I had no living relatives that I actually did. And they all happened to be in Australia. And that was a really major thing for me. After more than 40 years, I met someone and thought, oh, we share a tiny fraction of DNA. And I hadn't had that happen.
Wow. Was this through genetic testing? Is that how you discovered it?
I discovered it in a really roundabout way. A former student was doing some research for me into my family. And she was using a site called Ancestry.com. Mm-hmm. And it recorded her visits to my family tree. And my second cousin, I still sometimes stumble saying that, my second cousin Gail in Australia, also doing research, contacted my former student and said, is there any way of reaching Margot Livesey?
That is crazy. That's very coincidental.
It's so haphazard and coincidental because I just had given Irene a few questions that I was curious about. And I had not expected to find anything very startling or new at this point.
Right. I love that. So that was the original seed that kind of drove, that was the door in that drove this novel.
That was a big part of what drove the novel was that meeting and how it made me think again about families of affection, which my character Duncan has a family who've adopted him that he's devoted to, but he's still very curious about his DNA mother.
Yes.
I think the other main seed was, again, after many years, re-encountering an old school friend and asking him about his life and how it was that he had ended up in the States. And he described to me coming home from school one day to the tiny village where he lived and finding at the bottom of his garden the body of a young woman who'd been murdered. And he described how that very brief time, maybe just a minute or two, just changed his life.
Wow. Yeah. Well, before we have the cart too far ahead of the horse, why don't we do, I'll let you do a better job of introducing the novel and talk about kind of globally a boy in the field and this world that these, three characters inhabit. Can you introduce the novel?
I will do my best.
I know.
The Boy in the Field is set in 1999. In a couple of small towns outside the city of Oxford in England. And it begins with three siblings, Matthew, Zoe, and Duncan, walking home from their high school one September afternoon. And Zoe suddenly notices something in a field beside the road. And when they go into the field, they discover a boy lying there who's unconscious. He's been stabbed. And they get help and continue walking home. But that meeting on that September afternoon sort of jolts each of the three children into their own separate quest. The oldest, Matthew, at 17, nearly 18, becomes a quasi-detective trying to find out who stabbed the boy. The middle child, Zoe, nearly 16, starts looking at people, particularly at men, waiting for someone to recognize her, to truly see her. And Duncan, the youngest, who's adopted, for the first time becomes interested in finding his birth mother, whom he calls his first mother, and enlists his mother, his adopted mother, as it were, to help him in his quest. And the novel follows the three siblings over the course of the autumn as they each keep searching.
I love that it essentially is sort of a coming of age story, and this confrontation of evil at the same time. You know, it feels like it's the first time all three of them have really encountered something truly evil, like your friend discovering this body in his backyard. At the same time, they're discovering and confronting their own sexuality. And I thought, you know, that was just such an interesting juxtaposition throughout this whole book, and we can kind of unpack that throughout our discussion. But talk a little bit about, at this point in your life, being interested in a coming of age story, and what about that teenage point of view appealed to you now?
Now, this may be one of the things that I don't really understand about myself, Murray, is why should I come back now to writing about such young characters? But I think I do remain passionately committed, or I passionately believe that the lives of children are as intelligent and as interesting and as vivid as anything we experience as adults. And I think I wanted to capture the complexity of the way in which within a family, each person has a very different point of view as to what's going on in the family. Mm. That people are living under the same roof, but they're seeing the world very differently, and at a certain point striving for independence. And I find that conflict, that tension, if you will, very fascinating.
I think it's such a great time of life to explore things. I mean, your first experiences with all kinds of things are so much more intense and saturated with, you know, such brighter, more vivid color than at any other time in, you know, middle age, the rest of your life. It's you can't duplicate that experience. And something I started thinking about is how we're collectively, I know you're not originally American, but living here, we're just, it feels like we're collectively losing our national innocence in the last little bit, which is what this novel feels like. So in some ways, it felt really like a nice mapping on of kind of what we're all going through in certain ways, to what these children are going through in their own kind of specific ways. But I don't know, it just subliminally felt like the right novel at the right time in that regard. I don't know if you felt that.
Well, thank you for saying that, because in some ways the novel could seem completely irrelevant to what's going on now, to the Black Lives Matter movement, to the complexities of politics, to the pandemic, to all the upheaval in our world. But I think you're absolutely right that this is a kind of a fault line for my three characters, and life just isn't the same after they find the boy in the field.
And the really interesting choice to set it in 1999. I know that, you know, that was necessary for many technological logistics that were needed for the storyline. And there are so many of those technological logistics that I won't give away. But also, you know, it's 1999 was such an interesting precipice, not just, you know, this Y2K thing that didn't really come to pass. But, you know, it was pre-9/11. It was pre-iPhone. It was pre-social media. It was sort of our pervasive use of the internet. And so you were able to capture this kind of lovely time again of this like national innocence that mapped onto the coming of age story, you know, when they crossed over from 1999 to 2000, all three of these characters were kind of literally crossing over to something else in their lives. And I just loved that setting, that time period. Plus, it's just nice to live in a time period that isn't our own right now. It's a nice escape.
Yeah, and I remember, I don't know if you experienced this, that in 1999, people were talking about the millennium with considerable apprehension, and there were fears that somehow the internet would collapse, or planes would fall out of the sky, or there would be all kinds of disasters, none of which actually happened.
Yeah. No, I was practicing law back then, and you know, it was huge part of every contract was, you know, when the world explodes on New Year's Day, and you know, we're left without without computers. How are we gonna function? It was a major concern for people who don't remember or haven't lived through that time. It was significant. And in many ways, I would say, though that didn't come to pass, several other things unanticipated came to pass that were, you know, just as big of fault lines, you could argue. So it's interesting. So let's talk about these three characters and you getting to know them, who kind of how you got to know them, how you found their voice, who may have given you the most difficulty. Talk a little bit about exploration of character and how you go about that.
Well, for me, character is something that sometimes it comes in a headlong rush and a character does just leap onto the page. But much more frequently for me, it's a journey, like sitting beside someone on a bus going from, I don't know, Boston to Cleveland and gradually getting to know them. And in the case of these three characters, in the case of Matthew, I knew I wanted one of them to sort of stand in for a detective, even though there is an actual detective in the novel. And of course, in a way, I was playing with one of the tropes of detective fiction, if you will, when so many novels begin with the finding of a body and with that kind of mystery. And that was one of the several reasons why I didn't want my character, my boy, to be fatally injured. But I wanted to show a character who really has an adult intelligence in many ways, but doesn't entirely understand the rules of the world yet and is still bewildered that certain kinds of things can happen in the mm-hmm. adult world. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was I thought that's a very interesting threshold to be on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was he sort of your point of entry character?
I think my point of entry character was actually Zoe, who is the one who first glimpses the boy in the field and who then, you know, enters into this stage of restlessness, looking for someone that she couldn't have foreseen and doesn't really understand that she's becoming a young woman in certain ways. And then, of course, she does understand that she has certain charms and attractions and possibilities that she didn't know about before.
Tell me a little bit about, do you keep like notebooks about these people? Do you have images, pictures, things in your writerly toolkit or, you know, notebooks about these people of, you know, writing down their quirks or writing down their interests or, you know, kind of, or is it really done all in the narrative and, you know, everything you learn about them is done through the writing process?
I think it's some messy combination of the two. I wish I was a bit more orderly, but I'll have a photograph that I think of a young man that somewhat resembles my idea of Matthew. And then I'll be in a bookshop and I'll think, oh, he'd probably be interested in that book. And I'll ask a friend about music and say, so what songs would you listen to in 1999? And did you ever help your mother cook? You know, so it's a mixture of sort of having my antennae out and questioning people and also just remembering what it was like to be that age.
Yeah, yeah. I loved the Duncan character. He was such a great combination of still a little more innocent than his siblings because he's younger. But on this, as we were talking about at the beginning of the show, your discovery of relatives, this adopted boy, and that's its own sort of crisis of identity for a young person to not only be coming of age, but be coming of age around a family that is biologically not your own, and noticing the differences and similarities. You know, my siblings shared this with our parents that I don't have. And the choice to make his mother, I hope I'm not giving anything away, but the choice to make his biological mother, his origins, Turkish. And I was just wondering about that, all those choices, because they were so interesting and informed this character so much. So tell me a little bit about exploring the discovery that, you know, that his origins were Turkish, and a little bit more about his character.
Well, I had for a number of novels wanted to, I think, to write about someone who was an artist. So for me, Duncan first entered my consciousness as an artist, as a painter. Mm. My husband is a painter, and I spend a lot of time with him looking at contemporary art, and also talking to a number of friends who are making contemporary art. And I really wanted to explore that in a certain way, at sort of the beginning of the journey to being an artist, and the passions of that. And in terms of making Duncan Turkish, I wanted to make him physically different from his family, so that when people met the five Langs, they thought, oh, he looks different in some immediate and striking way that he has really almost forgotten about until after his encounter with the boy in the field. And I myself grew up with my father and stepmother, but I had this other family who lived nearby, and I gradually adopted them, and they have now become my family in many, many respects. But I am still aware that we don't share certain things. I don't have my adopted mother's lovely small hands. I don't have my adopted father's thick brown hair.
One of the things I really loved about this, both from a reader perspective and a writing sort of noticing how you did this perspective, is the major role of the minor characters. So we have the three point of view characters, but really in interesting ways, the minor characters, or the non-point of view characters, were the drivers of the novel. I mean, they were really the ones setting in motion what was happening. And you know, you come to understand how much minor characters can reveal the main character and can advance the plot. And the risk, I guess, as a writer, would be to not let the minor characters take over, as they really easily probably could have. Talk a little bit about how you think about the minor characters, and some of your favorite minor characters in this book, and you know, how they were the drivers of the storyline, or the drivers and motivations behind the main characters in many cases.
Well, I don't think you can write about three teenagers without having some sort of parental figure in the background. So right from the start, I knew that in conceiving this novel, I had to have parents, and I had to deal with them in some way. And I will say that I wrote many pages about the parents that have ended up in recycling, that I didn't want them to begin to overshadow or take over the novel, even though they have their problems and their crises happening in the background, which we gradually begin to understand. And I also I've read a wonderful piece in The New Yorker, an interview with a writer of detective fiction, and unfortunately I can't remember her name, but she described how the detective is the good person walking into the valley of shadow. And I thought that was such a wonderful description. And so I had originally not planned to have a detective other than Matthew, my teenage boy, in the novel. But I thought, oh, no, a detective could actually be really a good thing for the novel. And it could sort of nod towards the detective novel without without letting that form take over. And then I really wanted to have a dog in my novel. And I do think of Lily, the dog, as quite a significant character.
Yeah.
And so I auditioned various dogs to find one that was worthy for the family.
That's great. I love that idea about auditioning characters for a novel. I hadn't heard that before, but I really like that. That's interesting. I have to think about that more. Well, and the boy himself, the boy in the field himself, who is the initial driver of, you know, of the premise of the novel, and has page time, but you know he's kind of the engine behind this, but not necessarily at the forefront of, you know, of the action. I just think that's really interesting, to a way to think about the major role of minor characters, so to speak, and their own, you know, they have to have a little bit of their own backstory to be fully realized and fleshed out. But again, you know, there's the risk that they can start overshadowing the plot and how you, I imagine a lot of that is done, it sounds like, through the revision process of understanding the balance.
Yes, I would, for me at least, a lot of it happens in revision, that I usually have to write quite a lot to make the minor characters real for me. And then I try to pare away as much as I can so that they will be real for the reader, but not overwhelming.
Right, right. I also feel like it's a good reminder to writers, this initial trauma at the beginning of the book is a wonderful way to sort of organize the plot around something. I mean, I know a lot of writers in my writing group and elsewhere who, you know, you write 500 pages of, you know, fragments and you don't know what you have, and there's nothing kind of grounding it. And so having this boy found in the field to ground the action, to propel the characters off onto their journey, is a nice way, I think, you know, as you're transitioning, some writers transitioning from the short story to the novel form and feeling lost in the woods, a nice way to ground something into something concrete. I don't know if all of your novels have worked that way, where there's some event or some, you know, initial action at the forefront that sort of grounds the novel. I'm trying to think back.
I'm trying to think back too. I am very aware these days that that novelists, you know, have to be able to make a bid for the reader's attention very early in the novel, that we don't want to linger too long before saying to the reader, I am worthy of being read. And you know, that bid for attention can be in the language or the events or the characters. But in this case, I hope to convey some kind of combination of language and character and event to make the reader stop and pay attention.
Yeah. What were the sticking points in this book for you? You know, did you write yourself into a corner, and how did you get out of it? Or was there a character that really was confounding to you that you had to deal with? What were kind of the hardest parts of this one?
I think one of the hardest parts was deciding what sort of character the boy himself was going to be. He was at the center of everything, and I didn't want him to be idealized or mythical, but I did want him to be somewhat mysterious, and how to achieve that balance was a complicated undertaking. I wanted people to feel there was always a little bit of distance between him and them, between him and the world. And I also had to think a little quite carefully about what would it be like for Matthew to try to be a detective? I mean, I know there's tons and tons of detective fiction, but what is it actually like to try to find the perpetrator of a crime? How would you go about it? And that for me, that took a little thinking to find a plausible route for him to take.
Right, right. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Margot Livesey. The book is A Boy in the Field.
The other really interesting thing I wanted to talk about was sex and your writing of sex. There's a lot of sex happening in the book, but it's not really happening on the page. It's just sort of understood to be happening between, you know, a lot of characters. And that got me to thinking that if the sex is good, meaning it's happening the way the characters want and need it to happen, maybe it's unnecessary to show it. And, you know, that sex in novels is really interesting to the extent that it's shedding light on dysfunction or disappointment that's moving the characters or the relationship between the characters in another direction. But here it's the aftermath of the sex rather than the sex itself, which is what's important to these characters. And so maybe it's not as important to show it happening. And I wondered if you just had any thoughts about that and you know, when and how you approach sex or sex scenes, if you do, and kind of the role it serves, because, you know, all of these characters are coming of age, they're encountering their sexuality in different ways. And so how much kind of thought did you give about, you know, the kind of absence of the sex scenes themselves, yet the importance that sex was serving in the novel, if all that makes sense?
It makes complete sense. I have to say that I approach sex scenes with reluctance. My whole repressed Scottish childhood rises up before me. So,
right.
I'm going to pretend this is an intellectual position.
Yeah.
I do think that writing about sex is always a diminution, that one can never convey the complexity of the physical feelings through language. I have students at the Iowa Writers' Workshop who are writing fantastic sex scenes. And I always think of Scott Spencer's 20-page sex scene in Endless Love. I mean, I think you wait 300 pages to get there, but when you get there, it's just mind-blowing. In my own case, I haven't yet found the language, I suppose, the language that negotiates between the clinical and the intimate in an appropriate way. And so I think what I try to do is suggest the ways the sex is changing the relationship between the characters and how it's affecting their intimacy in other ways. But I do feel it as a limitation, and I wish I could somehow get over this blindfold, if you will. However, I remind myself that there are many wonderful novels in which sex is barely mentioned. So,
well, I draw attention to it almost because of your effective use of it through its absence. And and I think, as you know, I was trying ineloquently to say that, you know, if it isn't serving the plot and it somehow feels gratuitous, maybe there's not a need for it. Maybe there's the permission to skip it when the aftermath of it, the having of it, is the important bit, not it itself, you know. And so I think that's interesting. And I think it's good to be able to give yourself permission to work around things that are hard for you. I mean, I think there's a lesson in that itself, that if it's not your cup of tea, maybe it's okay to find creative ways to, you know, to work around it, as well as seeing the benefit of maybe leaving it out as well. I don't know. I'm kind of thinking through this as I'm talking, but it feels like there's something there.
Yeah, and I think that what you began by saying is also very helpful, that if the sex is going well, then what we're most interested in as readers is the aftermath. Reading about sex is not going to be as enjoyable for many people as doing it. So, but if the sex is bad in some ways, or is shifting the power balance between people, then I think we probably do need to read more about it.
Yeah, right.
Really good point. Really good point. I'd like to talk about sort of the self-taught novelist that you are. You had talked about, you know, somebody who came to fiction slowly. And I was wondering if you could just say a few things about your journey of self-teaching for people who might not be able to get an MFA, kind of how you would recommend going about this, the things that you found helpful in your journey to becoming a writer as opposed to becoming a reader.
I think for me, one of the biggest transitions in becoming a writer was realizing that I had to learn to read differently. I had to learn, as Francine Prose says in her wonderful book, Reading Like a Writer, in a way that took apart what was happening in the works I loved, that just falling into James Baldwin's Giovanni's room and being completely caught up in the fate of the protagonist was not actually that helpful to me as a writer. And it took me, quite a long time to learn that. And it also took me a long time to realize that, what was relevant in a story or novel? You know, what did I really need in a scene or an encounter? And how was everything advancing the story? And, as a young writer, I think I often wrote scenes that were just sort of marking time, oh, it looks like it's going to rain. Yes, indeed. those kinds of scenes. And it took me a long time to realize that a scene really needed to have subtext, and that a scene wasn't just showing as opposed to telling, that it was showing something that couldn't be told. And that felt like a really important discovery to me when I understood that.
I heard you say that you believe showing versus telling is some of the worst advice that writers have been given. I don't know if maybe I'm stating that too strongly, but it's vastly overrated or something. That telling has its place, and narration has its place, as opposed to showing every little thing. And I think that's worth dwelling on for writers, that not every single scene has to be shown and not told. And I don't know if, like a musician, you just get an ear for that, where, a little less tambourine and a little more drum right here, a little more narration, a little less showing.
I do know that, Virginia Woolf talks about the importance of rhythm in work. And I think one can develop a sense of rhythm, of the rhythm of one's own work. And, you think, I've had three pages of telling, I think it's time for a scene, or maybe not a full scene, maybe just a couple of lines of dialogue. Because, of course, readers love dialogue. And, I sometimes, reading particularly dense books, I'll confess, I sometimes flick ahead to see when the next scene is coming.
Right.
So it's just finding that balance between when you can really compress things effectively in narrative and when you can very usefully dramatize them in scenes.
Yes. Yeah. Do you, as you're reading as a writer, do you take a piece of, I don't know if you find a writer who's really particularly great at dialogue and study that on a, speech by speech level, or if you take something like Giovanni's Room and dissect it, like, does it look like different passes through? Now I'm going to take a pass through for how he manages suspense. Now I'm going to take a pass through for how he manages character, and so on and so forth.
I think it's more like dissecting, probably. That I might look at a scene in Giovanni's Room to see, how does he let each character talk? How does he keep remind us of the setting? How does he bring in the first person narrator's thoughts and feelings at various moments? How does he let us guess some of the things we aren't being told? And so it's more like just bearing down on a few pages of prose very closely, or in or in the case of Willa Cather, looking very closely at, I just read A Lost Lady, a wonderful novel, and there's a loathsome character called Ivy Peters, and looking at how Cather introduces him was just so instructive.
I love that. You've mentioned several literary influences. Are there writers that you feel are underrated, overlooked, that readers should have their eyes on that we might not otherwise?
Well, in a certain sense, I think almost all great writing is overlooked. I mean, people are stopping right. each other in the street and saying, have you read Bernardine Evaristo? Or, you know, who happily won the Booker Prize. I really am not sure actually how to answer that question. I mean, I think that I'm always coming across writers whom I feel deserve more attention in various ways. So I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer for this.
No, that is a good answer. That is a good answer. Yeah, I do think your note about most writers are overlooked, even the great ones are overlooked. I mean, I haven't read Willa Cather since college, I have to admit. And it's a good reminder to revisit some of these people for a lot of different reasons now. The way you would read her now is so different than the way I would have read her then. So, I think that's a good reminder. At some point you had talked about having private rules for yourself. And I don't know if that meant rules that you constrict, that kind of rein you in. I find that if I give myself different confines to work under, it spurs creativity. And I don't know if that's what you meant, but you were talking about each book having kind of its own set of private rules. And I was wondering if you could expand on that a little bit more and what rules you may have had for A Boy in the Field.
Well, I think when I first moved from mostly writing short stories to mostly trying to write novels, I thought at first, oh, this is fantastic. The open page lies before me and I can linger to describe the polystyrene cup and the dandelion and the license plate. And then I gradually realized what, the greatest sin in a novel is irrelevance, that novels have to have a sense of purpose to remain interesting, to remain engaging. And it took me a while to begin to understand that when I start writing a novel, I'm in a way setting my level of detail. And I can feel when I read other people's novels, how in the first two or three pages, they're telling me how much detail I can expect in the novel. Mm. And how much, the characters are going to dwell on things or explain things. Or I'm just at the moment reading Yi Yun Lee's Kinder Than Solitude. And, she just is very, very patient with the inner states of her characters and very lavish in describing them. And that's her level of detail for the novel. In The Boy in the Field, I had decided that I would try to write a short novel, by which I mean around 60,000 words, which happens to be the length of The Great Gatsby. And I was determined that however much happened in the novel, and I hoped a lot would happen, that I didn't want it to grow too long. So I tried to really pick and choose my details. So that was a major rule. And I think another major rule was that I would feel able to try to create a kind of transition so that I could jump forward in time and the reader would know where I'd gone. The reader would be able to jump with me, that I wouldn't need to catch every bus with them and make every cup of coffee.
Right. Well, and the structure of the novel
being told from three different points of view, where where you're always moving around, I think allows you to tackle it, not like a short story, obviously, it's a structure of a novel, but it allows you, yes, that latitude of movement, that now we're over here, now we're over there. And, it allows you to play with chronology a little more fluidly than if you had maybe a strict narrative. There's a lot of advantages, I think, to that structure.
Yes, I have written novels that have more conventional chapters, if you will, but I think of this novel as having sections that can be anything from two or three pages to maybe seven or eight pages for the most part. And I liked the way that allowed me to move fluidly through time and among the characters.
And you, I have read, are a novelist who always writes A to Z, that you just write a novel straight through and don't so much worry about the crafty issues at the beginning, but just sort of try and get everything down as quickly, not as quickly, but as organically as you can, and then go back to shape it. Was that the case for this novel as well?
I wish I could say it was entirely the case. It was mostly the case. I did have a long section in which my character Zoe went to work at the same hospital as the boy in the field, in the hope of becoming friends with him. And when I reread it, I just thought, no, this is getting me into a quagmire here, and ran to the recycling. So there were some definitely non-organic moments, I have to confess.
Do you feel like the finished product, was it a big surprise? Like, did something about it really surprise you? Because I assume, based on what you just said, you're definitely not an outliner. So, I'm just curious if the finished product of the novel sort of resembled what you thought it was going to look like when you first set out to write it.
In a number of respects, it really did. And in a couple, it really did not. And I don't really want to give too much away, but
yeah.
Connected with the ending, there were a number of things that were surprising to me.
Oh, that's the best. That's good.
Yeah, I think we want everybody, authors and readers alike, to be surprised by the ending.
I think so too, because I do think, if it's too carefully plotted out, which I guess most genre fiction is, it kind of tips your hand to the reader of what it's. I think if the writer isn't surprised, it's hard for the reader to be surprised. I mean, it's harder to kind of hide your hand. And what's the fun of writing if the writer's not surprised too? So yeah, that would be a shame, I think, if it finished up exactly the way you thought it was always going to finish up. And, not what's the point, but a little what's the point, I'd also, in our last little bit together, would love to talk about writing and creativity and working in this particular time we find ourselves in, and writing in the pandemic. Publishing in the pandemic, I think, is just dreadful, although maybe there's opportunities through Zoom that you wouldn't have otherwise had. But can you just talk about remaining creative and how you charge yourself when there's a lot of noise around us and a lot of, what's it all about, Alfie, kind of going on around us? Do you have any insights or advice on that score?
Like many people, I think I was just initially, gobsmacked by the pandemic. What is this? What is happening to our world? How can this be? But I think I quite quickly realized that I was among those extremely fortunate people who could still continue doing two of the main things I love, namely writing and reading. And that if I did not continue to do those, there would be something shameful about it. And so maybe within a week or so of the lockdown in Massachusetts, I started writing what I think might be another short novel, which has its key virtue at the moment is that it allows me to go to Scotland every day. Mm. I was going to go in June and of course couldn't. And so my novel is my way of going there. Of finding solace.
Do you feel any sense that writers have, artists in general, have some sort of activist responsibility in this climate? Or do you feel the primary job of the artist is, I mean, entertainment sounds a little bit pithy, but do you feel that there's a shift in objective at all in the creative endeavor in the environment we're living in?
I do think there's a distinct shift in the creative endeavor, and you know, I'm really, really interested to see where it will end up, because of course writing is pretty much like light from a distant star. It takes a while to reach us. So the novels we're seeing coming out now for the most part reflect the situation in which they're being read. And I do believe in activism. I've been to several Black Lives Matter protests. I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a liberal community that, like so many liberal communities, could do better. And I've been writing letters to my council people about various matters to do with the budget. And in talking to my students, activism comes up quite a lot, and we talk about what to do. But I don't at the moment, I keep notes on the present situation, but I don't at the moment have it playing a role in what I'm actually trying to write.
Yeah, right. It is interesting. I mean, it felt like after 9/11, it took maybe 5 years, maybe 6 years for, I mean, there are definitely exceptions, but a lot of literature to come out about, it took some time to digest it. And I've read actually a lot of short stories already now out about the pandemic. And it's funny to me, the different response that 9/11 took a long time for us to sort of think about and digest creatively. And the pandemic seems like, you know, people are really boots on the ground thinking about it in real time right now. And maybe that's just my own, you know, what I happen to have picked up then and now. I don't know, but I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
And for me, it's been interesting that although I've read quite a number of pandemic post-apocalyptic novels like The Road and Station 11 and Severance, to name three that come to mind, they've all been about total pandemics, you know, where there are just a few survivors, and we find ourselves living in a much more complicated state.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's hitting us on a lot of different levels, and not just the health level. It's oh gosh, we're out of time. I always say we have so much time, and then it still goes too fast when we have a lot of time. But we can follow you. You have a really wonderful website. Your name, I believe it's your name, Margot Livesey, LiveSey.com. That's right. Yeah.
Yes, that is correct.
And we can follow. I imagine you're going to have a lot of Zoom events coming up. So the advantage of the Zoom events is that people who aren't necessarily geographically located next to you can still go. So that's good.
No, and I myself have been happily attending, you know, Zoom events on the West Coast and in Chicago. So that is a great pleasure. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, you can almost reach a wider audience than before. I'm trying to look at the bright side of this, but, you know, it's anyway, this was such a huge pleasure. I sure appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Well, I appreciate your this wonderful conversation, Mary, and you've made me think not just about the novel I've just written, but, you know, what I hope to write in the future in really helpful ways. So I thank you for your insights and your eloquence.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. And I can't wait for our next one. I know there's going to be a next one. I can't wait. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Stay with us until next time. We will be right back here with you next week. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.